Beyond the Wrench with Jay Ginninen from Wrenchway.
Welcome back to Beyond the Wrench. My name is Jay Ginninen, and I am your host. Today, I have with me Jen Elstead, who is the Fixed Operations Director of Zimbrick Fish Hatchery Road. Jen has such a fascinating journey in the automotive industry and has joined us previously with Wrenchway events. She was recently a panelist at our third annual technician event where she took part in our Attracting Women to the Automotive Industry roundtable and discussed how shops can become more female-friendly. If you'd like to watch Jen's session of Techmission or any other session from the event, be sure to check out the link in the show notes below. Jen, how are you doing today?
I am great. A little damp from all the snow we got, but other than that, we were getting it cleaned up and we're good to go.
So Jen is in our backyard, essentially, the same area in Wisconsin, working for a fantastic automotive group. But as we record this, we got dumped on with snow this morning. So I kind of asked her how chaotic it was this morning. It sounds like a typical snow day, right? Fairly chaotic.
Yep, typical snow day, and it was a heavy snow, so everybody's fading fast this afternoon after exerting all that extra energy this morning.
Well, it's exhausting. I've lived in Wisconsin my entire life, and you never get used to shoveling snow. It is painful. So for all of you down south, I'm super jealous of all of you, and what you're probably experiencing right now is much more delightful than maybe what we are. I'm just not a fan of snow, as you can tell. So I want to talk. I'm so excited. You're the first person from Zimbrick, I think, that's on the podcast, and it's very cool for me as somebody growing up in the area. The Z has been iconic in the Madison area for as long as I can remember. And I'm really looking forward to being able to kind of pick your brain on all things service leadership. And I think there's a lot of things that you can do to explain some best practices to people, some advice to people. And so I look forward to that part. But before we get to that part, I do want to talk about your background, how you got to where you're at. It's a kind of a somewhat unique journey, but let's start with how you got in the automotive business in the first place.
Well, usually I say by accident. So I came to Madison back in 96 as a student at UW, and I was studying and did study vocal performance, which essentially means I'm a professionally trained opera singer, or at least was about 20 some years ago. My senior year, I wanted just to get a part-time job for the summer. I lived up the street from a Jiffy Lube that had just kind of revamped itself and was looking for a cashier. That sounded perfect. So I started working there. Within a very short amount of time, the gentleman in the shop said it wasn't fair that I got to sit in the air conditioning. So they challenged me to come out and learn how to work on cars. And I said, I don't know if you want me to do that, because if I do, I'm going to be better at it than you, and I'll be your boss. And I was right. So I graduated from college while I was working there still part-time, and eventually learned to be a technician there, so maintenance technician like you normally would have in your express center. And then just a couple months later, I actually took over the store as store manager. And that was my entry into the business many, many years ago.
So not one that you thought would lead to the automotive business by any stretch of the imagination.
By any stretch. And I always tell people when they are thinking about, you know, coming to Zimbrick or coming to any automotive position, you know, I don't know anything about cars. I'm not passionate about cars. I don't have any background in automotive. I don't have any training. I knew where washer fluid and gas went when I took that first job. It is definitely something you can learn, you can grow, and you can have a great career.
Yeah, and I think it's unique in that opera singing is about as far left of like the opposite side of automotive as you can get. But what did you aspire to be? Like you wanted to go and make that a career?
Yeah, I had every intention of, you know, moving away from Wisconsin and being on a stage somewhere. And ironically, my career has kind of led me to that, because as, you know, a leader in this company, you're on stage a lot. So despite the far difference, there's a lot of similarities and a lot of things that, you know, I learned from the theater and music side that come into play when you're talking to your people, when you're talking to your customers. All of that coincides with, you know, being able to do so calmly when you're really like nervous on the inside and not displaying it on the outside, to just being able to communicate with everybody. And I think that's one of the things I took away from university, was being in such a diverse group. I came from a very small town, not a lot of diversity, you know, learning how to communicate well with everybody and play well with everybody, especially in that kind of role where you're usually dealing with a lot of strong personalities, somewhat like the automotive industry. So it all correlates.
There's parallels. And I think the cool part of what you've done, though, is parlay that into your current day role, right? Like you talked about being able to have that presence when you're in front of people. And I think from a leadership standpoint, that's so important to have that presence and strong voice. And, you know, even in times that aren't so great or times that are great, like I think being able to be a steady voice and one that's not afraid to get out in front of everybody is underrated as far as a leadership skill. It is so important that you have that presence when you're talking to your team.
Yeah, I mean, it goes from talking to your team to not being afraid to step, you know, in front of your team to shield them from customers sometimes, or take over for them. Or, you know, it's just a confidence thing in general. If you can be confident stepping out on stage by yourself under a spotlight in front of thousands of people, not much else is really going to fluster you.
I personally would faint. That would be very, very difficult for me.
I probably would now. That was a long time ago. But you know, it definitely built my character into who I am today. Probably a little too much, some would say, but you know, that's what you get with me.
Oh, I love it. So when you got into automotive and when you're first starting out, was it apparent right away that it was something that you could see as a career or that you really enjoyed? I mean, going from the opera to underneath the car is a pretty stark cast, but when you did it, was it something that like clicked with you, like where you're like, this is pretty cool?
It was. And I think, you know, one of the biggest things that drew me to it was that sense of team that you don't necessarily get in a lot of other industries. You know, in that express center, you know, that was kind of back, in some places still do it this way, where you have 2-3 person teams working on a car. And if you aren't all on the same page and you aren't all communicating, and you know, it can go wrong really, really fast. And it was that sense of camaraderie, and then, you know, kind of moving up the ranks within that business and then into the dealership world. It was always about the people. That's what kept me at the job. I never really was like, wow, I love, you know, cutting my hands on this filter trying to get off of a rusted vehicle. That was never really the passion for me. It was the team. It was being able to build a great team once I got into a management role. It was that sense of accomplishment and that sense of camaraderie that has probably kept me in the business this whole time while everything else changes.
What led you to transition to the dealership world? So you had started off there, kind of got your feet underneath you, got that taste of management, but maybe wanted something more. What was it that kind of led you the dealership direction?
So that was back in the long, long ago when the express centers and quick lubes weren't really a thing for dealerships. And there was a dealership, our dealership, in fact, with Zimbrick. If you guys remember way, way back, GM had the Goodwrench service centers, and Zimbrick had built a Goodwrench service center, which had a separate express center. The great thing about dealerships is they dove into it when the brands and manufacturers told them to, but they didn't necessarily know how it worked and they couldn't keep up with the aftermarket because they weren't the pros. So knowing what I did there, I was able to come into Goodwrench and kind of whip it into shape a little bit to get that express center running the way an express center should, because it's very different than your traditional dealer operations back in the early 2000s. So that's kind of what transitioned me. My slow roll into the dealership world was the Express Centers that came out back then.
Thinking back to that time, what were the stark contrasts between the traditional Quick Lube and what you were doing at Goodwrench? Was it obvious when you got there the things that you needed to fix, or was it something where you kind of had to learn along the way and then kind of make some tweaks as you went?
It was pretty obvious right off the bat. There were a lot of changes made in those first couple of weeks that I think everybody had their heads tilted at me, like, does this girl really know what she's talking about? But it became very evident very quickly that we made the right decisions, from staffing to what we were stocking to how we handled appointments. I mean, that was still prior back when it was no appointment needed, drive in any time. You could have zero cars, you could have 20 cars out the back, all makes, all models. So between training and staffing and what we had in stock, how we worked on every make, every model, all of my knowledge from the aftermarket came in handy with that position. So we were able to grow that store that had the service center attached as well pretty well in the first couple of years I was there.
You were just recently on a round table with us for TechMission, and it was about women in the workplace in terms of the automotive industry. What was your experience kind of going into that management level in a dealership? And maybe you said that when you were coming in and making changes, I think it takes kind of a strong-willed person to be able to go in and make that impact right off the bat. What was your experience going through that as a woman in the automotive industry and really, you know, kind of just pouring your soul into it? How did that look like right off the bat?
You know, I had a good team and I had a supportive team, and it's kind of the same things that I try to get across to my team now when it comes to making changes. You have to communicate. You have to involve your people. You have to let them be part of the process. I have great ideas sometimes, but I certainly don't have all the great ideas. And the people that are doing the jobs, the people that are taking care of our customers, you know, definitely need to play a part in that so that it is a group effort. If I came in any situation, including the position I have now, and just said, we're going to do this because I said so, that doesn't work. It's never going to work. If it does work, it's only going to work for a very short amount of time. So if you can gain that buy-in from your people, you can change anything you want. So when folks say that, you know, oh, I can't make any changes, my crew won't support it, well, you got to get your crew involved. And eventually, you know, they'll go with you on that journey. You just have to lead them.
How much of that is building trust? Because when you're going in and you're talking to your team, and when they're thinking, hey, who's this person that's coming in and leading us? I have no idea who this is. And you're sitting down and listening to them and trying to understand their point of view on things. How much of that is an exercise in trying to just build trust?
It's 100%. That's all it is. And that goes for any situation in life, for the most part. If you want people to, you know, get on your team, you've got to have a relationship. There's no black and white line that says you're going to sit in your office all day and not know your people. You've got to know your people. They've got to know you. They've got to feel comfortable with you. You have to make a lot of right decisions right off the bat and show them that what you're doing is in their best interest. For 20 years, I've said the same thing whenever I come into a new store, is that, you know, I'm here because I need a paycheck and so are you. I ask that you would trust that anything I do, any change that we make together, any change I make, anything I ask you to do is in the best interest of you, the company, and our customer. Because it doesn't do me any benefit if it's not doing you any benefit. So, you know, I'm pretty transparent with everybody. And if they have questions, they can ask questions. If they want to argue, we'll argue. That's the trust factor is almost the only factor in building a team, gaining their trust, making the changes, moving forward, all of it.
I like the fact that you hit the elephant in the room head on, right? Like that it is about pay a little bit, right? Like that's the reason we're not voluntarily showing up to work. And we want to have a great team because the better we do, the better the collective is going to be, the better everybody's going to be, the better position everybody's going to be. And I think it shows some level of transparency there that, you know, I've seen managers where they kind of hide behind that, you know, that, you know, we'll not talk about money until later, you know. And I think there's a lot of power in just acknowledging that up front and getting through maybe some of the awkwardness that comes along with that so that you can get to the meat and potatoes type of stuff. Like that you're painting the why for them. Why are you there? What is your responsibility and what role in the team do you take? And I think by addressing pay up front, it allows you to kind of move that to the side and then talk about the things that are really, really impactful to make them live up to their potential.
I would never be successful if I didn't have a successful team. So everything I do needs to be to create success or a path to success for them. Otherwise, it's a short road and it's not gonna lead anywhere. So that's kind of what we focus on, the right people in the right place doing the right thing for our clients and the company. That's what we preach every day.
How hard is it as you grow, and I'm curious as to over the course of your career, how difficult communication is? You guys are a good-sized company. I'm sure you've had a lot of team members over the years, folks that like to be communicated to one way versus another way. How much of a challenge has that been over the course of your career, and was it surprising? Is it different than maybe what you thought when you first got in?
I don't know if it's necessarily surprising, but it is something that I definitely had to learn. You know, my background, having been, you know, in school for music, was this is the way you do it, and this is the way everybody does it, and if you don't do it this way, you're out, which is one of the reasons I didn't continue that path, because I don't necessarily like being told what to do. But I always think about it this way, is that I have one message, and I want to get that across to my team of, let's say, 20. I'm going to have to say it probably 20 different ways, and that's okay. So when anybody is talking about communication, the message is the same, but you need to know your people. You need to have their trust. You need to know how they communicate and how to word that message so that it gets through to them and it's, you know, it doesn't hurt their feelings. It's not offensive. They get the importance. And like I said, that could be 20 different ways. But when you know your team, you're already communicating with them that way on a daily basis, and you'll just know how to do it and it'll come naturally at some point. But you have to be emotionally aware of your team. You need to know them and you need to know how they communicate and you need to look at their personality types. You know, the DISC profile is a great thing for managers. Yeah. It's always that thing kind of in the background that they pull out at manager training once every 5 years. But, you know, if you dig into that and kind of know what you're looking for in those distinct personality types, you become a better communicator because you understand how your people want to be communicated with.
Yeah, I think that really, when you talk about a DISC assessment or any of the personality assessments, I do feel like over the years that's gone from just kind of a cool thing, a buzzword, you know, not necessarily people would do them every 5 years, that kind of thing, to where now I think there's a lot of businesses out there to where that's become a pretty fundamental tool for them to be able to understand personalities. Because as you're talking, I'm thinking, communicating with our teams is probably not a whole lot different than communicating with our family, right? Where you know your siblings or you know your kids, and how you can communicate with one might be different than how you communicate with another. And the more you can get a psychological understanding of how they operate and that not everybody's the same. I think that was one of the biggest growth pieces over the course of my career was understanding that there are different personality types. People think differently. You know, the difference between an engineer and somebody in marketing is crazy different. And It's hard to understand that.
Well, and that's kind of the same, you know, parallel to our technicians versus our advisors. We have very technical people on one end who are going to be the ones to find the wiring problem we've been looking at for 4 days. And we have the, you know, outgoing personalities of our service advisors and our front end staff who enjoy that customer interaction and, you know, the day-to-day of that scenario. So two completely different personality types. And when you throw in a number of others throughout what we work with parts and sales, you've got the whole disc wheel, the whole thing. So it's kind of a key to be able to do that. And it's not that when I hire someone or I meet a new employee, I pull out my assessment wheel and have them, you know, but in the first 5-10 minutes, I can pretty much tell what kind of personality type they're going to be. And I'm not wrong too much.
That's kind of a pencil you sharpen over time though, isn't it? Because you start to, once you have that understanding that people operate differently, and then when you're in that interview or you're in that maybe a discussion, you can really start to hone in on what that personality type is.
Yep, absolutely.
And so one of the things that I think is interesting when you talk about the different types of personalities are trying to find a place where we can fit a square peg in a square hole, right, rather than a round hole. And I believe it's Good to Great where they talk about getting people on the right seats on the bus. And mm-hmm. when you bring somebody in, I think in the past, our industry was really focused on whatever hiring for whatever aptitude they had, for whatever, you know, whatever their talent was. And I really feel like it's shifted, and I'm curious to get your insight on this in terms of what is your take on getting good people in and then finding the right spot for them?
So I like to do a lot of the first phone interviews for a lot of our positions. Most of the time, they are not going to report directly to me, and I ask just a few vague questions that kind of put them on the spot for them to tell me a little bit about themselves, what they like to do, what led them to apply with Zimbrick. And I go off those questions with follow-up questions because a lot of times what they applied for is probably not what they're going to want to do or necessarily be strong at. And that's when I start thinking in the back of my head while I'm talking to them of, where does this person fit in all the roles I have open? What's going to be their strong suit? And then I start talking to them about it. You know, this is what this job is. This is the job you applied for. From what you told me about A, B, and C, I also have this job over here, which probably didn't pop up on Indeed that day. And that's what this position is. Which one of those sound better? And a lot of the time it's the latter, and that's an easy call. On the flip side of that, sometimes somebody thinks they're going to really want to do a job or be really good at a job, and they get there and that's not the case. That doesn't mean they're not a hard worker. That doesn't mean they don't have talent. That just means they're in the wrong seat on the bus. And a good employer is going to take a good person and find a seat. Is that possible 100% of the time? No. Is it possible a lot with all the positions we have open as an industry, as a company? You know, it might not even be on my campus in general, but if somebody wants to do something or they're working in one department and they see something in another department that really interests them and that's kind of their end game, let's do it. Let's get you in the right spot. And we've had a lot of success doing that over the course of the last year, where typically it could have ended in a termination or somebody just leaving the company. We never want to lose good people. So if it's just I'm not happy in what I'm doing or it's not my strong suit, let's find out what is and see if we can get you on that path.
That was totally my path growing up, by the way, where it was starting off as a technician and a terrible one at that, really bad. But it took me finding the right spot for, you know, kind of the light switch to flip, right? Where it was like, once you started to see, I just always thought I wanted to be a technician. And then when I found out that that really wasn't what I liked, and nor was I all that good at it, it was so rewarding to be able to go to a different position, and I had to go to a different company because I left my dad's small shop, right? And so I went elsewhere and saw that there were opportunities outside of my dad's little shop. And being able to learn and see that there were things that I did have a lot of strengths in, however, it wasn't what I thought it was so mind-blowing to me. And I think that's something that stuck with me throughout my career is being able to find the right fit for people, assuming they're a good person and that they're smart. Like, there's always opportunity with us for that. And I think that's changed in the automotive world over the years. And I don't know if it's changed since you first got in, but, you know, I think we've really shifted from you're lucky to have a job here to, you know, really catering to that employee and trying to find that right fit and having the patience enough to even find that right fit. And I don't know if you've seen the same thing over the course of your career, but it does feel like we've had a big shift.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the shortages of staff in general, I think, play a little bit into that. But the trend, you know, started, I think, to that. But yeah, I mean, it was. There was a plethora of people that wanted to come into our industry. So if somebody wasn't the right fit 20 years ago, it was, don't like it, you know where to go.
Yeah.
Whether it was just a conflict resolution situation or not the right fit for the position. And I don't think any company is in that position these days. If they are, more power to them, where they've got, you know, people knocking on their door to come work there. But, you know, they always say all the good people already have jobs. So chances are we've got all the good people. We just need to make sure they're doing the right thing and that they're happy doing what they're doing.
Yeah. And I think we're far more attentive to happiness now in current day automotive industry, which is a pretty exciting thing to see. I do want to revisit one topic that you had brought up before that I think is always ever fascinating one to me, which is the technician advisor relationship, because I think that plays so much of a role into the happiness of a technician is the relationship that they have with their advisor and how, you know, maybe they're not the same personality type, but trying to get them rowing in the same direction so that they're really on the same page.
Video is becoming an increasingly important tool for recruiting technicians. Wrenchway Shop Talk Videos gives technicians an inside look at what it's like to work at top shops across the country. Shops share all kinds of authentic, unscripted videos that gives an inside look at the shop's culture, people, facilities, and benefits of working there. You can also filter videos by location and category. To check out what it's like to work at shops in your area, visit wrenchway.com/shoptalk.
Do you see challenges there that, and maybe let me rephrase that, what kind of challenges do you see there? Is it more so them not quite understanding how important the other one is or how important they are to each other? I think a lot of cases that, you know, if they could put themselves in the other person's shoes for a day, they might see it through a different lens. How do you see that relationship?
It's critical. I mean, it plays into the entirety of the team. And I think at Zimbrick here, we don't focus so much necessarily on that particular relationship. This company does a really good job of breaking down the silos in general, the sales, the service, the part silos, and helping us all make sure that we focus on one end goal, and that's taking care of the customer. And then it is a joint effort, and how are we going to work together to get that done and make sure that we're all taken care of, you know, in the meantime. So it's definitely a culture thing. You know, we've brought a lot of new advisors in over the course of the last year or two. And, you know, that has to be kind of set as a standard right across the board, is that whatever decision we make, everything we do all day long has to be in the best interest of the customer, the company, and the employee. And I think that as a guide helps. When you look at a friend group, there's usually a bunch of different personality types, and yet they all get along. So it's definitely a balancing game. You can't have a whole team of strong personality and a whole team of not. Probably won't get too far, or you're going to be breaking up a fist fight. As long as you're creating the right balance, and I think that goes right back to what we were talking about finding the right place for people. You might have an advisor for one team that isn't the best fit with that team, but would do great with another, and vice versa. So it's matching people up with people who are going to complement them and that they can work together with, and that all their strengths shine in those situations. So again, it's knowing your people. It's having the trust of your people. It's leading your people to work together. And as leaders, you better be showing it when you're out there. You need to make sure that you're working together with the sales managers and the parts managers and, you know, all your other peers in the management arena to set a good example that we are on one team and we do have one goal.
I think I had read that customer satisfaction will never be greater than employee satisfaction. And when I say that, we're actually customers of Zimbrick, right? Like we take my wife's vehicle to the Infiniti dealership there, and you can feel it when you walk in the dealership. Like my wife feels comfortable taking her car there, feels comfortable talking to the group in general. And I think that, like everything you're talking about there, kind of parlays or like it translates over to how the customer feels. And for a decent size automotive group, that has to be tough to kind of manage all of that. But in every interaction, I've bought vehicles there, my wife's bought vehicles there, and taking them in for service. And it feels that way when you come in. It feels warm. It doesn't feel intimidating. And I have to believe that part of how we feel when we walk in as a consumer is a lot of that, right? When you've driven kind of that happiness and you've got the people on the right seats on the bus, how much does that relate to what a customer sees?
All of it. Every single bit. If there's tension behind the scenes, that's really hard to hide on the front end with our clients. So having that kind of seamless teamwork and, you know, everybody actually being on the same page is critical. You know, we have multiple workshops. They have multiple different ways of operating, whether it's the team system or dispatch, or, you know, even how our advisors handle things from the technicians to parts. And we do what works for each of our rooftops and all of the people that are in each of those rooftops. But yeah, if you don't have a cohesive group, you're not going to have a cohesive experience for your customer. And it is 100% correct that unhappy employees are not going to give great service. So we try to make sure that our people are comfortable in what they're doing. They're given the tools they need to do their job, and they're playing with the right team. And that's one of the things we've really focused on over the past year at my campus in particular is, you know, building the right teams. And when we bring new people in, they have to, I don't care if they know anything about cars. They have to show our core values. They have to have care, concern, respect for our people and our customers. And if they don't have that, it's definitely not going to work out, because that's kind of critical. You know, there's a lot of companies out there that have vision statements and mission statements and things like that that are on a piece of paper, but Zimbrick really tries to live by our core values, and we bring it up and we talk about it every single day. And, you know, that's ingrained. It's printed on the walls here. You can't walk through a dealership without seeing it. And we hold our people accountable to living it. And I think that's critical for our success.
Yeah. And you see it reflected in everything that you guys do. Everything you do is very top notch. And it's, you know, again, this is a little bit more of a Homer podcast just because I grew up here and I've seen it forever. But it is something that the brand has consistently been that way for a long time. Like, it has been a destination place to work. And I want to pivot to that a little bit in the challenges in recruiting talent and maybe how that's changed over the years. You know, I think one of the unique things about Zimbrick, and I had shared this with you before, is that you guys are such a good brand that I almost felt intimidated about coming to put an application in. So I graduate tech school and I come from small town Wisconsin, and I see the big Z when we go down the main highway here in Madison is the Beltline, and Zimbrick is just flooded all the way down the Beltline. And it was challenging to me to even get up the courage to even go apply. And so I didn't. And so as we look at that, I'm interested to hear if that's just an isolated story with me or if that's an actual challenge that you have.
I think it's definitely a challenge. It's not one I hear about often, but if I'm not getting someone to apply, period, I'm not going to hear about it. It's kind of like the problem you don't know you have. On the flip side of that, I think one of the other challenges is just our industry in general, people not understanding that technicians, while critical, they're absolutely critical. We can't do business without them, don't get me wrong. But there is just a whole broad spectrum of other positions that we need. And when they see that Zimbrick, that's automotive, that means cars. I don't know anything about cars, I'm out. When so many of our positions, that's not a critical knowledge coming in the door. And so that's one of the things that I struggle with is customer service positions, service advisor positions, BDC positions. You don't need to know anything about cars to be successful and have a good career path in this industry. It's getting your foot in the door. If you're good with people, we'll take you the rest of the way. And that's the message that's hard to get out because a little bit of our reputation of being Zimbrick. You know, people kind of think, well, I can't be customer service there because somebody asked me something about a car, I'm not going to be able to answer. So they pass it by. And I can relate to that because that's kind of where I was when I entered the industry, but it was taking money and I could handle that. So I went for it.
I think it's cool that you have that story to be able to share too, right? That where you didn't have the traditional background coming into automotive, yet look where you're at now, right? And I think being able to not only talk about career paths and being able to talk, you know, just tell them, hey, you know, we have a lot of opportunity, but here's my background. This is how I grew up. And it was not my plan to be in this position, but I worked my tail off and I ended up in a pretty great spot.
Right. And, you know, we have that story so many times in this company. I mean, we have current general managers who started off as lot porters. So it's kind of what we do. It's finding those good people and getting them in the door and finding out what they're good at and putting them on that path and then helping them get to where they want to be. And that's really what I'm striving to do, you know, these days is to just get the good people in the door, figure out what their talents are, and then get them in the right spot so that we can help them. And it's going to play a key role in our retention because that's a huge thing for every company right now, especially with the bidding wars on every single job out there. You can't drive anywhere, especially in our area, without seeing now hiring. And, you know, there's sandwich boards that are outside where I drive past once a week and it's $15, $16, $17, $18 for all these entry level positions. And at some point we got to offer more than a dollar sign. You know, for a lot of our entry level positions, there has to be a reason for them to want to join us and then stay with us. We don't have 30, 40 year veterans at this company because of a dollar sign. I can guarantee you that. It's our culture and it's the career paths that we offer and the success in an industry that may not have been what you thought you'd wind up in. That is what we have to offer as not only a company, but an industry as a whole. And we've got to start finding a way to get that message out there.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Wrench. We'd like to take a minute to talk about this week's sponsor, Jasper Engines and Transmissions. Okay, your customer's engine or transmission has failed, but now is not the time for them to trade in their vehicle, not without a working engine or transmission. Besides, would they have kept their vehicle another 3 to 5 years if their engine or transmission had not let them down? If you answered yes, then Jasper Engines and Transmissions is your choice to give your customer vehicles new life and many thousands of miles of enjoyable driving performance. When considering the high cost of a new or newer used vehicle, there's a pretty good case to be made for replacing a drivetrain component that has failed or is delivering poor performance. Rather than trading in their car, truck, van, or SUV, install a quality remanufactured Jasper product for less than your customer would have to invest in a new vehicle or a newer used vehicle. Check out their website at jasperengines.com to learn more about the money-saving value of Jasper.
How much of that do you think will come from storytelling and being able to really showcase being able to tell those stories in general, right? Like, so the stories of that porter that worked their way up to a GM position, you know, how effective do you feel like that piece of the equation is, or being able to stand out to that person that might not think they're a fit for Zimbrick?
I think it's huge. Recently, I attended a chamber event with a speaker that the issue at hand was about marketing and marketing through emotion, but that was a big part of it is storytelling. How do you market to people, which is technically what we're doing when we're recruiting, we're marketing ourselves, and it's storytelling and it's making that emotional connection. How do you connect with your audience? You know, the dealership ads and the automotive ads of old where we just say we sell and service cars and it's a great place to work aren't going to cut it with the generation we're looking for. They want to know why. They want to know what our involvement in the community is. They want to know, they want to hear from people that have been here the 20, 30, 40 years on why, what's in it for them? You know, what's going to make them be here 20, 30, 40 years? How did they do it? Do we have those pathways to success? It's 100% getting our stories out there and sharing those genuine experiences from our own employees on this industry, this company, and the success they've accomplished by being here and sticking with it.
Do you think it's forced growth from you as a manager or as a leader in being able to adapt maybe your style to that side? Just interested in learning more about that side of it. Did it force you to maybe think differently than you did 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
I've thought more outside the box in the last 3 years, I think, than in my entire career. And I think that's going to have to continue. You know, back in the day, it was the aftermarket going, what are the dealers doing? And the dealers going, what's the aftermarket doing? And that went on for 15 years of my career. And that's who we watched. We watched the other guy. And we're all at a stalemate right now. So, you know, a couple years ago, it kind of transitioned to, now we got to watch what other companies are doing. What are the Amazons doing? What are these large companies doing that are seeing this growth that aren't having problems filling their positions? But at some point, we got to ask ourselves, what are we doing? And, you know, there's the phrase of, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Well, yeah, we kind of do. We can't just necessarily improve on what we're currently doing. We got to reinvent it. We have to look at our industry as a whole. We have to look at our parts and service departments. How can we operate better? How can we offer what the next generation wants as a workplace? The manufacturers need to do it just as well as, you know, our distribution centers for parts and everything else. It's going to have to change as a whole, and it's going to take dealerships and service centers and the aftermarket to one at a time step over the white line and make some bold decisions and some bold changes and take some risks that we haven't had to do in 50 years. But it's time. We are either going to change or we are going to be left behind.
What a cool message there. And I think that is very powerful. And the way that I've seen our industry evolve over the years, and this is just my kind of viewpoint of it, was it went from, you know, me growing up in a small town, maybe I was a little bit more shielded from this, but we went from, yeah, I would never take a tech from my neighboring shop, to then people getting to a point of desperation to where they're basically exchanging techs back and forth. And now to the point to where I think everybody is starting to kind of wrap our arms around each other and saying, let's fix this thing. Let's get more people into the industry because we've got a bottleneck there that is killing us right now. And I think to me, you know, for our company, we very much view ourselves as kind of the middle ground between everybody. And I think that, and again, maybe it's just because of the evolution of my career personally, but it does feel like we've shifted now to, okay, let's fix this thing. Let's stop, you know, the Wild West. Let's just kind of fix this thing at its core. And I think that takes, you know, making sure we're treating our people top notch. That takes, you know, maybe working with what would be perceived as a competitor to try and make a school better, or, you know, I try to get more power behind a school. Is that just me, or do you kind of see a similar evolution of our industry?
It's definitely starting. I don't think we're there yet, but it's definitely starting. You know, we have seen a lot of companies just in this area start doing some of the things we started doing, which is really investing in our technicians and recognition and apprentice programs. And as you said, working with those schools and, you know, giving them the tools they need to enhance their programs so that in turn they can attract more kids into those programs. I think there's more work to do. You know, it's changing the perception of our industry, and that's going to take time, but it's something we have to focus on, as well as, you know, we've got the 16, 18 year olds that we're after to get them into tech school or into our workshops. But what are we doing to make our industry something that a fifth through eighth grader wants to do? You know, they're getting bombarded just as much as the high schoolers. How are we changing the perception that this is a good career and a good route to go? So that's something we have to do kind of in tandem with our current recruiting efforts, is think about what are our recruiting efforts going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now? How are we going to get, you know, how are we going to change our reputation, so to speak?
And you're spot on. That's an industry-wide issue. And that's something, you know, as it relates to that middle school age kid, I actually just had a local high school instructor in the office here today, and we were chatting about this. And I said, I am the most awkward person in the world in front of an eighth grade class. Like, I don't mind going and presenting in front of professionals and adults, but when I got in front of eighth graders, it was like a fish out of water, and it was so uncomfortable. I was just so bad at it. So I was asking for tips on how I could get better with that. And I think, similar to what you're saying, I think we've got to look for ways to adapt and almost meet them at their space or at their level, rather than trying to force something down their throat that isn't something that would be appealing to them. And it's hard. Like, I personally am still a disaster when it comes to that. So it's one thing that I look for in my future growth of, okay, I got to get better at that. I need to get better at being able to go talk to young people and tell them about this industry, because there's an abundance of opportunity and there's a lot of really, really good things that we can do. But I don't know if that is a general concern that people have, or if it was just my experience in going into that middle school class and feeling awkward.
I mean, it's certainly not something we're used to. I mean, the recruiting to that age group seems, when you think about it, kind of crazy. Why are you guys going after 12-year-olds? But it's not necessarily recruiting. You know, one of the things I hear the most from some of our apprentices and folks kind of entering the industry now is they've come across automotive by accident. Well, I started dating someone who was into cars, and so I sat around and watched them work on cars, and I started helping them work on cars, and it turns out I really like working on cars. Or, you know, I went to visit my uncle and he's super into cars, and I got into cars doing that. They just weren't exposed to it. It wasn't an option. So it's not even recruiting. It's just letting them know it's an option. It's getting something in their hands, whether that's a class, whether it's a, you know, after school activity, anything to let them explore what this industry is and what it has to offer. And if it's something that interests them, you know, how many kids who aren't already into cars are going to take an automotive class their junior year of high school? They're not. They're not going to take that. That's not the just for fun to get an A and bounce out the door class. So it's getting it out there, you know, early and getting them some experience in what we actually do and what it is, you know, that this industry can hold for them to spike that interest early and get the kids who would have the talent to work with us interested in having that as a career path.
Well, and as we look at some of the transition to electric vehicles and it may be the different type of talent we're going to need when we look at young people. I mean, that was, I know Zimbrick had just worked with a local high school and we talked about it in some different content that we've done, but they were bringing electric vehicles over and some other ICE vehicles that were incredibly fancy and taking them to the high school and being able to let kids kind of get in and check it out, you know, in a way that maybe they wouldn't have access to otherwise. And I remember talking to the high school instructor and him talking about how much it opened their eyes to how cool some of this stuff is. And the fact that you could even, you know, touch a Porsche or like, you know, some of that stuff. So I think that visibility element is absolutely humongous to us, our entire industry moving forward.
Yeah. And I think you're right. As we move into EV and the vehicles just continue, whether they're EV or not, getting more and more complex, I want to talk to the kids that want to go into engineering because that's what we are going to need on the flip side. You know, it is one of the things I talk about in our apprentice program is that we're getting pretty far away from just turning a wrench. It is computer science. It is engineering. It is, you know, a background knowledge and an interest in all of that, which could make a really successful technician for us. One of the most successful apprentice start-offs I had was a young man who started off at the university here as an engineering student and decided he couldn't sit behind a desk. He wanted to work on stuff. He still wanted to do the engineering, and automotive fulfilled that for him. And, you know, he went on very quickly into more of an engineering background in our industry. But we need that mix. It's not just a righty-tighty, lefty-loosey position anymore. We need really intelligent, talented individuals to be our technicians, and we need to make sure we're taking care of them once we get them in the door.
One of the hardest parts about that and appealing to maybe that student that's looking to go be an engineer, I think a lot of cases are the parents, right? They know that their kid is smart and they know the stigma behind our world and what they think it is, but maybe perception doesn't match reality. That visibility goes a long ways with those parents too, and being able to talk to them and, you know, making sure that they feel like just because their kid isn't going to that four-year school or is leaving that four-year school to come work with us, that it's not the end of the world. Like, it's actually a pretty good career choice in that you're not going to accumulate a ton of student loan debt and you're going to still have a great career where you're probably going to make pretty good money.
Yep. And I think the schools are doing a little better job of that with the education on the value of 100%. Trades and what those career paths look like. But we need to be standing right there next to them going, here's your example. Like, yes, it's on the brochure, but here's, you know, we need to be bringing our technicians to those events so that they can talk to real people in this industry and not just, you know, the service directors or the parts directors, you know, they have to see it. Seeing is believing. So the more, like we talked about, getting our stories out there, what does this really look like behind the scenes? And it is behind the scenes because when you come into a service center or a dealership, what do you not see? The technician. You don't see anything that's going on. You don't see all the machines hooked up. You don't see the, you know, tech classes that are talking to the engineer at the other end of the line, seeing the same thing you do to diagnose a vehicle. They don't see the tech side of that. They don't see the engineering side of it. Everyone's car just magically goes back. Whatever's wrong with it gets fixed. And it comes back out and they're dealing with their smiling service advisor, which is great. That's the experience we want our clients to have. But it doesn't necessarily do us a whole lot of justice when we're trying to be transparent in what these jobs really look like and change the perception of our industry.
Kind of off topic, but how did you guys become the cool brand? And when I say that, like the logo, the way the dealerships look, the brand as a whole, for my entire life has been just cool. Like it's a really cool place. How do you think that came about? I don't know if that's purposeful or if it's just, you know, to me, it always has been just a cool brand.
I think it started probably before I was born. It's like, it's always, Zimbrick's always been here. Zimbrick's been here longer than I've been on the planet. And again, I think it just comes down to the culture and the values that we're held accountable. You don't earn a reputation like this company has by doing it right, kind of, sort of, sometimes. You have to do it right every time, or at least make a darn good effort to be doing it right. And I guess if that equates to cool, we'll take it.
Well, I think,
but that's kind of what it is.
I think there's so many companies that are old like that, and not just in the automotive industry, but in business in general, that have been around for a really long time and they get stale. Like they don't stay kind of fresh, or they don't stay, you know, kind of different. But that's one of the biggest compliments I can give all of you at Zimbrick, is that it has stayed fresh and it hasn't gotten stale. Like that brand and the qualities of that brand have continued for a really, really long time. And I think, you know, as we talked a bit about leadership today, I think that is true leadership. I think that is being aware that, you know, just because we're great today doesn't mean we're going to be great tomorrow. We need to continually work at this. And I think that is the ultimate compliment to any business or to any brand, is that you didn't get stale, you stuck by your principles, and it's led you to, you know, you individually and the business to what it is today. So I as I'm thinking about this, I'm just blown away that it never felt like there was a drop off. And you look at any sports team, you look at any business, like there's always some level of roller coaster, if you will, but it's always felt like Zimbrick has just been consistently good.
And that is a nod 100% to our leadership, from John starting the company now to Tom and the leaders that Tom has selected for each of his dealerships. That's where it starts, and that's where it stays. And he does a phenomenal job. I had the honor and pleasure of getting to know John when I started with the company 20 years ago. Made an impact on me, obviously, because here we are 20 years later, and I'm here. And, you know, again, it's those personal connections. It's building the trust with your team. It's leading your team in the right direction, and it's your team wanting to follow you in the right direction. And that starts at the top down. And this company is a statement to that.
That is cool. And it is, I think that's a lot of times where the drop off happens. If you go from one generation to another, or you go to one ownership group to another, or, you know, whatever it might be, to prepare to keep that stability during a transition. And we could do an entire podcast on that alone, I think, but it is not easy. It is not not as seamless as you all have made it look. I think that's a huge tip of the cap to everything that you guys do. And just in general, to brag you up a little bit, I've known of the Zimbrick Automotive Group for my entire life, and it is just an incredible place in general, from both the customer side, client side. You guys are great partners of ours at Wrenchway. And just all in all, I think you guys live what you talk about, right? Like you talked about the mission statement being on the wall and your values, and that it's not just something that's written. It's something that is really core to your organization. And I think from an outsider's perspective, that is such a cool thing to see. And I just want to thank you and everybody at Zimbrick for everything that you do, and hope that you keep up the good work, because a lot of people benefit because of it.
Well, I appreciate that. And we love to hear that. And, you know, if you ever get up the courage to put in that application.
Jen, I'm still a terrible tech. I still can't do that. So I think that might have been some of the apprehension too, is just like, yeah, if I go there and I suck, I'm kind of screwed. But no, thank you so much for taking some time to join me for the podcast today. Hope you had fun.
This was a really fun conversation.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
That wraps up this week's episode of Beyond the Wrench. Be sure to tune in next week for another brand new episode. As a reminder, don't forget to rate and follow Beyond the Wrench on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. This helps us get Beyond the Wrench in front of other fantastic shop owners, managers, technicians, and dealers just like you, so we can continue to help improve, promote, and grow this amazing industry. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back next week.